Now, what his provocation is, when you read this essay, he says to his reader, he says, if you're reading this essay, you are petty bourgeois, okay? Now, most people who are cultural and academic thinkers would probably like to align themselves more with a more radical designation. But he says, no, you are petty bourgeois for doing this, and the defining feature of the petty bourgeois is they belong to a class that they denounce. Most petty bourgeois people don't like this class, even if they are petty bourgeois, okay? Now, it's not so common term, but the avant-garde always use petty bourgeois or even bourgeois as a term of abuse. The bourgeoisie were clear. The bourgeoisie exploited working class labour. Even when they barely had enough to eat, this is in the classic days of first capitalism, the working class could live in terrible conditions. But the petty bourgeoisie, Enzensberger argues, is that they're in an in-between class position. They don't own the means of production, and they're not really creative entrepreneurs. Now, in the 19th century, the petty bourgeois was known as being nervous, irritable, easily incensed, easily annoyed. You know, gets cranky very quickly. Ugh. Annoyed by everything. And they had bad taste. That's what a smug Philistine means. It's very bad, terrible taste. But Enzensberger argues that there's a new kind of petty bourgeoisie in the late 20th century. And this new petty bourgeoisie expands with the growth of tertiary and what he calls the quaternary or the fourth sector of the economy. So it's an area that grows as you move from industrialization to services economy and, you know, an education, higher education sector, an expanding higher education sector. But he says this is what's puzzling about this class. The more it grows, the less you can see it. It's less recognisable. You can't actually represent it so well. It's hard to say, oh, this is petty bourgeois, this is not. Solidarity and collective ideas, like with the working class, are not there. It's the most fragmented class in history. Its relation to the means of production are derivative and indirect. That is, they're not central to economic life. But what's really strong about this class is its many-sidedness. It has many different features. And this makes it hard to define, but it makes it incredibly flexible as a class. It has tenacity, dynamism, that is, it's always changing. And dynamism, remember yesterday, is one of the key explanations or definitions of modernity, that it is dynamic, it's always changing. Okay. So he says this class changes too. In short, it's very adaptable. It never takes a stand and is able to seize every possibility. And then he says it's the experimental class par excellence. So that is, it's the class that brings innovation. It invents ideologies, sciences, technologies. It produces art and fashion, philosophy, architecture, criticism and design. I guess if Enzensberger was here today, he'd say, by definition, we who are here listening to this would be petty bourgeois. He said what's really telling about why this is important then is that the whole area of mass consumption is more or less shaped by the ideas of the petty bourgeois. They are like the avant-garde of taste. So they've set up a new hegemonic class that is not a class, barely definable as a class. But you can find this class everywhere. You can go to Finland, you can go to England, you can go to Brazil, you can come to China, Australia. They're going to be everywhere. So this analysis is not only just an analysis in 76. Enzensberger was arguing about this idea, this is what the coming class configuration will be. The petty bourgeois is frenetic in their productivity, capacity for innovation, because its survival depends on being innovative. Its beautiful dreams will always roll on irresistibly until it has reached the souks of Damascus or Shanghai Airport. Probably got there a long time ago. Now, he was writing this, remember, in 1976. So he was talking about, you know, Shanghai as part of this new cultural, even then, in 76. A few things about what he says. This idea predates someone like Richard Florida on the idea of the creative class by almost a quarter of a century, 25 years. It's not so familiar in the English language to hear this term petty bourgeois anymore. New terms like creative entrepreneurs, creative class, creative industries are now taking perhaps the place of this term. But what's interesting is the diagnosis, the characteristics, the elements of this culture that Enzensberger talks about. He says, is this a question of a culture at large switching from a nation state, a Fordist level, to international multilateralism, a culture mimicking wider socioeconomic alignments? Now, what's interesting about these questions is Polker is fascinated by this provocation. And the question, I guess, for us today is that how much does this match the idea of a creative economy or a creative economy vision? I'll just quickly say a few things then about what Polker pulled out of this. Polker is a very, as I said, much more ironic than Richter. When he's talked about what he would do again in life that would be any different, Polker was known for being what we'd say drug-addled. This is what I meant about his trauma. He had a terrible childhood, and it's a consequence that he takes up too many drugs in the countercultural period. But then he says, the thing I learnt from drugs, the most important thing, that the conventional definition of reality and the idea of a normal life mean nothing. And he even does works on this. It's called, in English, Pills, simply Pills, from the same year. Now, one critic says with Polker, what Polker points out is the abstraction's historical failure, this idea that its radical promises in today have become part of Polker's humour. He pokes fun at these pretensions that art could lead part of a social critique and lead the path to a new world. That sort of commentary relates to... I don't think that's right, to tell you the truth. It makes Polker seem that his humour is very directed, and I think his humour is directed, but I'll explain where I think it's directed at. And I think there's actually... This is meant to be a throwaway line, but I think it's serious, and I'll explain why as well. He pokes fun at abstraction, the idea that abstraction too leads from a simple view to historical destiny through culture. And this work is a simple work where it's white at one end and in the top corner it's black. And the work literally says, higher beings command, paint the top right-hand corner black. And this is a joke of, like, who are these higher beings? Are they artists or are they Martians? Who's the higher beings who direct that painters do these abstract works? Okay. But the argument is, like, painters are directed by historical destiny to go a certain path, a certain way. This is what the joke is. And it's about this... conventional wisdom is this pokes fun at the idea of being destiny's co-pilots. So it's like a throwaway line, it's like a joke, a one-liner joke. And it seems to fit in another thing Enzensberger said in a different text about May 1968. This relates a little bit to the diagnosis Justin said, that the whole thing was a carnival, meaning it's, I think this is much more of a flippant line by Enzensberger, but it feeds into some of the aspects Justin was talking about yesterday. It's not simply a social critique, but a lifestyle thing. And Polka is interested in this idea of higher beings, though. He does this work, also part of this series, The Petit Bourgeois, and it's about Franz Liszt likes to come to visit me to watch television. That's literally what it means. And this is a picture from this woman who's looking out like she's seeing a ghost. This is part of this commune that they lived in. And the idea for this came from the idea of a medium. And one of the things Polka was interested in this time was television, the whole idea that nearness and distance became quite changed by television. Things that could be very far could be brought close, and they could be brought close at the same time. And he also included this image he got from a newspaper, and it was a woman called Rosemary Brown who claimed to be in contact with Franz Liszt, the composer. And she said she was a medium, and she was from Northern England. And when people asked her how she communicated with Franz Liszt, she said, this man appeared, she claims to be not very musical, but this man, and she described him, looks very much like this. Polka weaves this story into his analysis of We the Petit Bourgeois. And this woman even produces an album. What she claimed to do was that Franz Liszt appeared to her, and first of all people said, well, how did she communicate with him, because he was German, you know, they speak in German, or, you know, in she said, well, all these great composers, Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Liszt was the medium who communicated these dead composers to her, and they said they'd all been composing in the afterlife and creating music. So she released an album of all the music that these dead composers had produced since they were dead, and it's available. You can get it online. And so Schumann, Liszt, etc. So that's one bit of classical music Justin's not up to date with yet. So what is this about? I think there is a humour in it. This is by a book called Simon Critchley, on a book on humour. And he says, when you view the world in a very comic way, what you see is the world with its causal chains broken, its social practices turned inside out. This is a little bit what Enzensberger is suggesting that the petty bourgeois are doing, this sort of way of constantly innovating, changing. They don't have any particular shape. They're moving with technological transformations. And so the social practices get turned inside out. And humour has this way of doing this as well. And I think one aspect that Polka really tries to keep together with that quote is this idea of there is that element of the social critique that's still available, and it's not necessarily aligned to a clear class destiny, but at least in the classical way, but it really relates back to this idea of Rosa Luxemburg. Freedom is always the freedom of those who think differently. And this could be, this was one of her major catch cries, but I think this is what Polka is sort of suggesting. This element of artistic vision is still alive. It's all about making people think differently about social practices, and present different ways of representing this world. So this classical ideal of modernity is still strong. And I'll just show quickly a few works by Felix Gonzalez Torres, who's Cuban, to just to show someone who the idea that contemporary art, unlike modernist art, is not restricted in geography. Modernist art was always cosmopolitan or international, but really it starts from very few centres and spreads outward. Contemporary art is everywhere, and but it's not that clear-cut. When Gonzalez Torres went to study in New York, he said he was the first Hispanic there to teach, and people always confused him when he first there with the janitor, the person who cleans or works the lift or is the cleaner, because that's what Hispanics were traditionally doing in America at that time. Some people are, what sort of artist is Gonzalez Torres? Another key question. You could say he maybe is a sculptor. He never paints. In fact, he's dead now, so he was never any of these sorts of things. He actually studied in photography. Photography was his chosen profession. But he did works like this that are taking every... This is, again, this thing about the collapsing of high and low modes. These are ordinary office clocks. All he does is put them together. And one of the key things that Gonzalez Torres is interested in is the idea of life and the couple. What makes a couple? Now, there's a particular poignancy about this for Gonzalez Torres. He was living in New York at the time when the AIDS virus came, and he actually had the AIDS virus, so he saw his life ticking away and his partner's life ticking away. But he said it wasn't really what he wanted to convey, or was not just about him or being gay, but about every couple. Because every couple, you put the battery in and you set up as a couple, but inevitably one battery will run out before the other. And you can set it up again, but this is, and they're also closely aligned, but the clocks are always slightly different. You know, they almost seem to be together, but slightly different. So this very simple means he wants to talk about these very fragile aspects of everyday life. So it uses everyday means to talk about an everyday situation. Okay. Another thing that he does is to transform the very idea of what is a work of art. Normally you go to a museum and you have guards and they tell you to stay away from the work, okay? You have a rope or something. Gonzalez Torres uses... Gonzalez Torres is quite a left artist, actually, but he uses a traditional thing from the Caribbean of and the Catholic Mass of transubstantiation, which literally means you get a wafer and there's this idea of communion that you're taking part of the host or of God. He uses this then, again, everyday life, it's just lollies or candy, okay? And this is a type of sculpture that comes and disappears, and it's the exact weight of his partner Ross, as you see there, Ross in LA. It was his weight, because he was being measured every day as he was dying to see if the drugs were working to help him. And as people took one of these pieces, you would see the body of the work dissolve. You could, but each day then, they'd replenish it to the same weight. Okay, and these works still work the same way. This is how they survive. But the thing is, they're incredibly colourful. And the first time I saw one was a whole row of gold lollies. And as you walked around it, it changed and glittered and transformed. So they're very visually evocative. And this is one of the things Gonzalez Torres wanted to do. He said he wanted to make the aesthetic important again in life, to talk about everyday important things, but to have very minimal means to explain quite complex practices of art and how they relate to complex practices of life. And even after he died, there was a work, he was the official entrant of the American Pavilion, so he became quite official in the end, because he lived in America for a long time, became at the Venice Biennale the 2007 representative. Again, you have the couple idea. What these are, two huge marble discs, and water flows over from one to the other, and as they fill, the water flows out and overflows. Just a very simple idea, again, the idea of the couple. And then just to show you these items of candy, there's a very particular licorice that you could pick up. And it's interesting because adults are used to not intervening with work, and it's only the children who usually go down and pick it up because, you know, we know we're told not to partake of the work. And some of the works are just these curtains, these sort of fragile little sections, the in-between place going from one hall to another. So it's sometimes very easy to miss these, but you can play with them and they're quite playful. So they're very different types of work. Why I pick them is not whether they're male or female or which part of the world they came from, but for the different questions they raise. This question of, I guess going back to Justin's thing about the social and artistic critique. This second part relates to a paper I sent here, but it's from a book, and I have my own particular take on what's happened, so I'll explain how I think some of these things are working out today. What I see is there's a series of perpetual tensions that remain. Rationalization, that is, we need to incorporate things in everyday life, make them part of the process, but then we also have creativity and innovation. We have perpetual change, and we've sought for some type of coherence from this culture that is of innovation and change. And as we saw in some of these works, but also some of the things Justin talked about yesterday, the loss of critical agency, what is the critical person, or its transformation. The thing I didn't mention yesterday is leisure and productivity and their blurring. In modernity, you get a clear link between productive time and leisure time. It may be short, but it's more or less always legislated where there was a strong union movement. Today, we're witnessing the blurring of this, where you can have certain social media that are used by your workplace, but you also use them for your own social life. You know, everyone's texting, connecting, doing their Facebook, connecting with their friend, but also your workplace can be using these things. So there's a blurring of what's the productive and the leisurely. So the piece I gave you is from the first chapter of this book, and I just want to talk about one particular aspect that people have sought to explain and change and resolve. So I start with, what are the words we're talking about? Now, in English, the word aesthetics comes from Greek. It literally meant not art, but it means senses. Raymond Williams argues basically that what happens to these words, art, culture, aesthetics, with modernity, is that they move from being a shared collective idea, art that all understand. Remember, there was a question yesterday, people don't understand Joyce. Well, he argues that there's a shift toward more specialized, and he argues more subjective understanding of all these terms, and a trend to what he calls isolated subjective sense activity as a basis of art as distinct from social and cultural interpretations. Williams's fear is that you were moving from the objective to the subjective in art, and this has been where the meanings have gone to. In fact, most people really in the English-speaking world are more familiar with the term anesthetics, because when you go to anesthetist to maybe if you get your teeth fixed, it's called anesthetist. It's anesthetic, where you have no sense, so you can have your teeth fixed.